Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A gun reform debate comes to the Capitol today. One bone of contention, what exactly is an assault weapon?
All semi-automatic rifles and all semi-automatic shotguns will be banned if this amendment goes on the ballot and is passed.
Also this week, one Florida lawmaker's claims drugs like Ritalin are major factors in mass shootings.
I mean, those drugs are continued as they grow older, because it's almost like once they get on it, they can't stop.
We'll also learn that a federal prosecutor is offering to help prosecute marijuana possession cases because Florida now lacks the resources to determine what's illegal pot and what is legal hemp. And we'll also discover the stress of being a TSA agent may have fatal consequences. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Earlier in the month, the state's financial impact estimating group struggled to define certain portions of a constitutional amendment petition that would ban assault weapons. Today, the group met again, and this time they invited the petition sponsor, Ban Assault Weapons Now, and others to help clarify portions of the amendment. Blaise Ganey has the details.
Thanks to House Bill 5 passed by the legislature last session, financial estimators now have to prepare financial impact statements for any proposed constitutional amendment by Citizens Initiative. In the group's first meeting for the petition aiming to ban assault weapons, members struggled to define the intent of the amendment. So Chief Economist Amy Baker called a new meeting.
Our hope by the end of the day is to have a good working understanding of what the amendment does so that we can start talking about and preparing discrete impacts.
To assist the group, Charles Tate, a volunteer for the petition sponsor, described exactly what the amendment's intentions are.
I am a former member of the National Rifle Association. Additionally, I have been in possession of a concealed weapons permit since they were made available to qualified citizens of this state.
Tate says even with his love for guns, he wouldn't mind turning his assault rifle in to help solve what he calls a healthcare problem.
I believe it to be the number one preventable cause of death and injury in our state and, frankly, in our nation.
In 2017, nearly 40,000 people were killed from firearm-related injuries nationwide, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But not every firearm is an assault weapon, and Tate says the amendment is only trying to outlaw specific guns that could fit that description.
All semi-automatic rifles and shotguns that are capable of accepting a detachable magazine or other ammunition feeding device. All semi-automatic rifles and shotguns that are equipped with a fixed magazine with a capacity over 10 rounds.
But former head of the National Rifle Association, Marion Hammer, says that definition would ban every semi-automatic gun simply because of the word capable.
That one word, capable, with respect to fixed or detachable magazines, assures that all semi-automatic rifles and all semi-automatic shotguns will be banned if this amendment goes on the ballot and is passed.
Tate disagrees and thinks capable means something that allows a gun to be easily altered. He acknowledges that gunsmiths can alter guns after they leave the manufacturer, but he says the amendment is focused on what the gun was designed to do. In the meantime, the estimating group is going to determine what definition they will use. Their next meeting is September 9th. I'm Blaise Ganey.
Pensacola Republican Representative Mike Hill wants to repeal gun safety legislation passed by Florida lawmakers after the deadly school shooting last year in Parkland. He says the measures, including a state ban on bump stocks and a provision raising the age to purchase a rifle, violate the Second Amendment. He also says firearms aren't the cause of mass shootings. Regan McCarthy has that story.
WFSU caught up with Hill while he was waiting for a flight at the busy Atlanta airport. Hill says mass shootings are not a problem that should be solved by the government.
Just because an incident takes place doesn't mean that the government has to react. We as a society need to react instead. We need to look at, first of all, it starts at a very early age in school. Well, just because a hyperactive child is now diagnosed as ADHD, when back in my day in the 60s, it was simply that you were told to go sit in time out or calm down. Now they give them drugs, psychotropic drugs, Ritalin, to change their behavior. And then those drugs are continued as they grow older, because it's almost like once they get on it, they can't stop.
Hill claims that's what the majority of mass shooters have in common.
Whenever you see or when you study a mass shooting that has taken place, that those young men have either been on or are currently on prescribed psychotropic drugs. That is the issue.
Hill isn't the only person who thinks that. His statement closely mirrors an article by pro-gun publication Ammoland that's been circulating on social media in the last few weeks. The article reads, quote, "The single largest common factor in all these incidents is the fact that all the perpetrators were either actively taking powerful psychotropic drugs or had been at some point in the immediate past before they committed their crimes," end quote.
That doesn't necessarily seem accurate to me.
Jillian Taranovic is a professor at Florida State University. She's building a database on all mass shootings that have occurred in the U.S. since 1980. She says if overprescribing psychotropic drugs like Ritalin were a cause of shootings, researchers would expect to see the number of mass shootings increase along with an increase in the use of drugs. But that's not what she sees.
Given the social construction of mass shootings and their visibility, especially in recent years, I think most people would assume that they are, in fact, increasing. But our data thus far don't really suggest that that's the case. They seem to have been really prevalent in the 1980s and 90s. And over time, we actually see that the trend is quite stable.
Taranovic's counting mass shootings by sifting through media reports and documents from the FBI. She's found more than 800 cases so far. The Ammoland article, which claims all mass shooters in the past 20 years have one thing in common, lists just 39 cases, some of which aren't mass shootings at all. And Taranovic questions how the article's author collected their data.
In my data collection efforts, like, we're relying solely on like publicly available, accessible information. And so to the extent that if we were to code for that in our data, it would be an anecdotal report. So it would be something in a public case file that was unsealed, or it'd be like in a news report, you know, an account from like a mother or a friend saying like, you know, this person had mental health problems and they took a lot of Ritalin or whatever.
The prescription of all medication is pretty closely protected by HIPAA, and HIPAA doesn't end upon someone's death or incarceration. So I'm curious as to where the data came from, because that's a pretty federally bound secret between a prescriber and the person taking the medication.
Jay Reeve is the CEO of Apalachee Center, a mental health facility in Tallahassee, Florida. He says even if someone were able to collect information about what medicines mass shooters had been prescribed, he hasn't seen any evidence to back up the idea that psychotropic drugs, or drugs used in a psychiatric setting, would cause someone to become a mass shooter.
Yeah, I'm kind of trying to think of what psychotropic medication would have the impact of turning somebody into a serial killer, and I can't think of one. It's just not. Now, that's not to rule out that, but I'm pretty confident in saying that's not something that's popped up in the research anywhere, at this point.
Reeve says it's likely true that someone who's willing to commit a mass shooting is not a person with a healthy mind. But he says being mentally ill or taking psychotropic drugs does not mean someone will become a mass shooter. In some ways, that's similar to what Representative Hill says about guns.
There is no statistical analysis that shows because you confiscate guns from someone with this so-called red flag law, because it is gun confiscation. There is no study, no evidence at all that that prevents a mass shooting from taking place.
In other words, Hill is saying just because someone has guns does not mean they will commit a mass shooting. Taranovic says when looking at the issue, it's important to understand the idea of cause.
In terms of causation, that's different from correlation, in that two things can seem to be really correlated, but it doesn't necessarily mean that one is causing the other. For instance, like ice cream sales and homicide are actually correlated, but we're not saying that ice cream sales cause homicide. Homicides are actually, they're more frequent in the summer. People are outside of their homes more.
The difficult thing is, Taranovic says researchers haven't found a cause for mass shootings.
You know, this is human behavior. It's multifaceted. It's complex. There are biological factors, familial factors, just your individual factors, neighborhood factors, cultural factors, you know, that all come into play to influence how people behave at a point in time.
Taranovic says it's incredibly difficult to predict who is going to become an offender or what would make a person stop offending.
It's complicated to predict that kind of stuff. And so in terms of like causal associations, I think a big trap that policymakers often fall into is trying to find simple solutions to complex problems. And trying to identify or boil down, you know, really complex human behaviors into one or two factors is typically where we go wrong policy-wise.
I'm Regan McCarthy.
Florida Department of Health Deputy Secretary for Operations Michelle Talent is on administrative leave. Turns out she's the subject of an internal investigation, as state officials confirmed to the News Service of Florida last night. Talent has filled a variety of roles at the department, including helping to hold down the fort in Tallahassee before new Department of Health Secretary Scott Ribkes came on board this summer. Before being named Deputy Secretary for Operations, she served as the director of the department's budget office. That's according to the agency's website. Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida's newfound problem prosecuting marijuana cases has at least one U.S. attorney offering to help out. The Capitol Region State Attorney is saying thanks, but no thanks.
You know, we're in a transition right now trying to get up to speed with this change in the law and get the testing done.
The stress of being a TSA agent may have been too much for one agent at the Orlando airport.
There wasn't, you know, somewhere along the line that that could have, you know, we could have avoided that.
And the search goes on for better ways to preserve, protect, and defend Florida's coral reefs.
Florida Aquarium is the first in the world to use this Project Coral land-based spawning technology.
The U.S. Attorney for Florida's Northern District says he's willing to review and prosecute marijuana cases that the local state attorney will not. Ryan Daly reports the move comes after State Attorney Jack Campbell said last month he's pressing pause on prosecuting marijuana cases in light of a new hemp law.
Confusion over a new state law legalizing hemp led State Attorney Jack Campbell last month to say he will stop prosecuting marijuana possession cases. Here's Campbell giving his rationale for the decision.
So there's literally no state lab in the state of Florida that can do testing and say this is hemp or no, this is marijuana.
Hemp and marijuana come from the same plant, and field tests police use can't tell the difference between the two. Now, U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Florida, Larry Keefe, has stepped in, releasing a statement Thursday night that his office will review and potentially prosecute marijuana cases in federal court. It advises local police departments and sheriff's offices of Keefe's willingness to do so and requests state attorneys allow their assistants to be temporarily sworn in as special assistant U.S. attorneys to assist in prosecution of the cases. At the time of this recording, a spokesperson for the U.S. Attorney's Office had not answered WFSU's questions about specifics, but Campbell says he sees it as a helping hand.
Basically, the federal government has resources beyond the state. And I don't think that's a surprise to anyone. And I think that that's, I wish I had the resources of the DEA and the FBI. And I appreciate Mr. Keefe being willing to bring that to bear.
Asked if he thinks those federal resources include or are specifically referencing testing labs, Campbell says he doesn't yet know, but thinks it's likely.
My assumption is that either the DEA or the FBI or some other federal entity would be able to do the testing that we're in the process of figuring out.
The U.S. Attorney's statement doesn't get very specific about the threshold a marijuana offense would have to cross to be prosecuted in federal court. But it does say federal prosecutors would consider the seriousness of the crime, the deterrent effect of criminal prosecution, and the cumulative impact of crimes on particular communities. Campbell points out it's entirely up to Keefe.
He's the U.S. Attorney. So he could decide on what cases, the parameters. He seems to put some language in there suggesting that he has some type of decisions on where to set the gauge, so to speak.
Confusion surrounding the prosecution of minor marijuana offenses in a post-hemp law state has extended far beyond North Florida. Local law enforcement around the state have halted marijuana arrests in light of the new law. In South Florida, Miami-Dade and Martin County officials have arrived at the same conclusion. It's also a problem in other states like Texas. In June, the Texas District and County Attorneys Association issued an advisory that says the state's laboratories aren't capable of distinguishing hemp from weed. Meanwhile, as Florida's Department of Agriculture continues to craft rules for its hemp program, a spokesperson for the agency has said it's looking into the issue. I'm Ryan Daly.
After a TSA agent named Robert Henry jumped to his death inside the Orlando International Airport in February, agents came forward to say Henry was bullied at work and that TSA has a toxic work environment. Our sister station, WMFE, found dozens of TSA workers across the country with similar stories of workplace harassment and retaliation. Health News Florida's Abe Abaraya reports on two TSA workers who have been hospitalized for suicide attempts and thoughts.
Allison Demzon is a transgender woman working at Denver International Airport. In 2017, a new supervisor began misgendering her over and over again.
You know, go grab him from over there. Well, which him? Allison, that person, you know, stuff like that.
In October of 2018, a disabled woman in a wheelchair didn't want Demzon to do a pat-down because she was transgender. Afterwards, her supervisor berated her.
I just couldn't take it anymore. I just fell apart for a little while and started crying all over the place and had to be sent home.
Demzon was hospitalized on suicide watch. She had two previous suicide attempts before working at TSA. Demzon returned to work after she passed a fitness for duty test 2.5 months later. She filed an equal employment opportunity complaint against TSA in 2018, saying she was discriminated against because she was transgender. She is far from the only one. TSA had more than 400 EEOC complaints filed in 2018. Christine Griggs is with TSA's Office of Civil Rights and Liberties. She said the number of TSA complaints is down and more are resolved before becoming legal cases. She says TSA has a similar number of complaints as Customs and Border Patrols, which has a similar number of employees.
So if you take that 400 number and you look at all of our employees as a whole, it represents a little bit less than 1% of our total population of employees.
Greg says now TSA is rolling out suicide prevention training. She said she was shocked to hear Robert Henry wrote in a suicide note, "Tell my managers I'll be waiting for them in hell."
I mean, it's heartbreaking. You know, it's really heartbreaking that someone would, you know, get to that point in their life. And more importantly, that there wasn't, you know, somewhere along the line that that could have, you know, we could have avoided that.
Former Transportation Security Officer Becky also worked at Denver International Airport. We're not using her last name because she hopes a successful EEOC case will let her be able to return to work for the federal government. Becky says taking time off for a medical procedure kicked off a year of harassment and retaliation.
They don't look at us as people. They just look us like we're like just ants in a giant hill, and they step on us whenever they feel like it.
She missed months of work without pay and was eventually fired. That sent her down a dark path, and she was hospitalized twice in the next 3 months for suicide attempts. She says she immediately related when she heard about Robert Henry's suicide in Orlando.
And my heart just broke in a million pieces. Because I was there and I could have been him.
Now, Becky is packing kitchen gadgets into a big Amazon box before her home is sold. She needs the money to pay for her lawyer.
It's very expensive, $350 an hour. So, I have to sell my house and find somewhere else to go.
For Allison Demzon, she says lawmakers overseeing TSA have to stop playing politics.
I would want them to know that while they're sitting on their hands, people are dying. It's that simple.
Demzon is back working at Denver International. She spoke about her experiences during Suicide Awareness Month. She says afterwards, 10 or more TSA officers came forward and asked for help. I'm Abe Aburai in Orlando.
If you or someone you know is depressed or thinking about suicide, call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. For more than 18 months, the U.S. and China have been engaged in a trade war that has kept the global economy on edge. This week's stock markets have been volatile, and while economists try to predict the long-term effects of the economic standoff between the two countries, WGCU's Andrea Perdomo tells us the impacts are already being felt by a local nonprofit.
So watch your step. The swamp, it'll try to steal your boots.
Will Ravel is tending a tree planting site that has become flooded after days of rain. The site is the latest endeavor of Ravel's nonprofit organization, OneTree.org. Since 2007, OneTree has had one objective, to plant as many trees as possible to combat deforestation.
It's just my passion project. I'm just trying to save the planet here. You know, I this is not a business like where we're trying to make a buck or anything. We're just trying to plant trees, especially here in Florida. It really needs it.
OneTree, like many nonprofits, relies on donations to do its work. Ravel started a fundraising campaign on the website Kickstarter that used custom tote bags as an incentive for donors. Problem is, the bags are made in China.
I did not even think of tariffs at all. But I really just, I don't know how tariffs work. I just had no idea that that would even be a factor, and nobody mentioned it.
Not the bag vendor or the customs broker Ravel used to help him import the bags. That is, until it was time to have them shipped.
It was like I had been sucker punched and I was seeing stars. He's saying 25%, and I'm like, what does that mean, 25% of what?
Tariffs, which is another word for taxes, are not charged on the shipping costs of having items brought into the U.S. They're charged to the invoice of the items purchased from China.
And I feel like a fool. I guess I should have studied tariffs. It just literally never crossed my mind. This has not been a thing in my lifetime.
Ravel figured he would be in the hole about $500 to $700 in order to ship the bags to those who donated to his campaign. But the added cost of the tariffs is actually going to set him back a little over $2,000. Money that he says the nonprofit simply doesn't have.
We're going to get these tote bags no matter what, even if I got to put it on a credit card and, you know, just lick my wounds for a while. These bags are going to be here. I'm not going to let them sit at the port in Miami.
Ravel says he hopes to have the bags in his possession by the end of the month. I'm Andrea Perdomo in Fort Myers.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, a laboratory in Apollo Beach is the home of an attempt to preserve Florida's coral reefs, which are dying at an alarming rate. WUSF's Steve Newborn takes us inside the lab to see how scientists are getting coral to reproduce.
I walk into a building alongside Tampa Bay that hums with water pumps and creatures that look like small brains. There, I meet a woman who is part scientist, part matchmaker.
Carrie O'Neill, senior coral scientist at the Florida Aquarium.
O'Neill has a rather unique job.
I've been called the coral whisperer, the coral queen, various different names.
What she does is try to get coral to create little baby coral. And just how do you get coral in the mood?
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby.
We do actually play Barry White during the spawn time, but I think that actually gets the humans in the mood a little bit more while we're staying up and all night waiting for these corals to spawn.
It doesn't seem to me like it's...
One of their tricks is mood lighting, which gets redder later in the day, simulating a Florida sunset. As it dims, a glowing ping pong ball high above the tanks mimics the light of the silvery moon. All this matchmaking is needed because Florida's once colorful coral reefs are under siege. Warming seas, ocean acidification, and diseases like stony coral are leaving parts of the world's third largest reef a ghost of their former selves. So enter the Florida Aquarium's groundbreaking Coral Cupid Connection.
The Florida Aquarium is the first in the world to use this Project Coral land-based spawning technology to spawn Atlantic corals for restoration.
O'Neill says coral doesn't cross-fertilize themselves very well, so they have to mix the eggs and sperm from different colonies. Florida Aquarium CEO Roger German says this is the best way to diversify the genetics of coral, giving it a better long-term chance at survival.
So right now what we are doing is we are arcing, in essence like Noah, you know, trying to arc the coral just to protect it and save it. We are learning how to grow it for the eventual put back in the wild.
All this is for a species that spawns once a year. If you miss that opportunity, O'Neill says you'd better be prepared to wait.
And you're sitting here and you're waiting and you're staring at it and your eyes are playing tricks on you. And then all of a sudden you start to see these bundles migrate up into the mouth. And then all of a sudden they all start releasing and it's like a snow globe in the water. And then we're like, it's happening.
O'Neill says Florida's coastal waters are beset by local runoff and pollution and global issues like too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that makes oceans more acidic. So coral, like many species across the planet, aren't able to evolve fast enough. So what's to prevent stony coral disease from infecting these little guys once they're back out on the reef?
If we can produce 10,000 coral babies, let's say, of this grooved brain coral, and we put those back out into the ocean, now this is 10,000 new genetic individuals that maybe some of those now are expressing the right type of characteristics that may be more resistant to warm water, may be more resistant to nutrients in the water.
O'Neill says they've only figured out the reproductive cycles of 5 coral species so far. That's only about 10% of the number of species found in Florida. So they've got a lot of mood lighting and maybe a little Barry White in their future. I'm Steve Newborn in Tampa.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Gainey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Steve Newborn, Andrea Perdomo, and Abe Avaraya. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.